Fantastic Beasts, and We Don't Mind Them. In honor of the favorite, what's your favorite cinematic pest?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with Chance from Homeward Bound, not only because he was voiced by Michael J. Fox, and at this period of my life, I love Michael J. Fox, but he's scrappy, and he doesn't want to be loved, but he really does want to be loved.
I'm Matt Patches, and yes, this is recency bias, but I'm going to go with Olivia, the little white puppy dog from Widows, previously seen in Game Night, according to a viral tweet from Katie Rich.
Claim to fame.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven, and I'm going with Gizmo the Mogwai from Gremlins, because he's very cute, especially when he sings. You just got to be careful when you feed him.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I guess this is also recency bias, but I am going to go with Oakja from the film Oakja, because not only is he very cute, but if you guys ever... What's that?
Is he a pet?
Yeah, I'd say. He's pet enough.
I don't think
pet slash friend, as all good pets should be.
Okay.
But, yeah, and then if you guys are on the outs, you can always eat him.
I was certain you were going to go with Bunzo.
Bunzo Aww. Would make a great pet.
Do you still have the hedgehog?
Yeah.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 239. It's the week of Wednesday, November 21st. No, it's not. 21st? Oh, yeah, it is. Thanksgiving's
it's
early
the
this year.
Earliest day Thanksgiving can occur.
I was going to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving, and it all just
you
sounded so wrong. Everyone in the United States and anywhere that you would like to eat a hearty meal with gravy, happy Thanksgiving. We have reviews this week. We're giving thanks to you all for leaving us reviews. David, are they
good? Let's see what they say first.
Are they good reviews?
We should make a point of only reading 5-star reviews, maybe. We have 2 4-star reviews this week. I mean, you can leave us a 5-star review and then shit all over us.
What are we, Donald Trump? We can't handle our own criticism?
No, it's not that we can't handle it. It's just, you know, we can leave a 5-star review and then call us assholes. That's fine. It's all.
That is the appeal of the podcast, from what I understand.
But, you know, a 4-star review calling us all masters of the universe does not do us as much good. Not that I know that's what these have said. I'm just speculating. I have not read either of these reviews, as per my custom. To read them for the first time on air, C.D. Holden says, good podcast, wrong on Roma. This is a great podcast with excellent chemistry between the four hosts. However, I have to take advantage of the fact they will literally read every review out loud in order to deliver a public service announcement. See, the system works if you work it. Last week, the hosts mentioned that Alfonso Cuarón's Roma was only playing in New York, L.A., London, and Mexico City. Excuse me, I don't believe the hosts mentioned that. I think Matt Patch has mentioned that, and the rest of us were too up our own butts to correct
it. I wasn't even on
the
podcast.
That we knew. Someone said it.
It was definitely David.
It was me?
It was only playing those things.
My specter came in.
There's no way.
Fake news.
I said that because I...
It was probably me. That sounds like something that I believed is true, so
that's also
tell me why I'm wrong.
It sounds like something that I believed.
At least the first week.
However, this is not correct. It is most certainly going to be screened at the E Street Landmark Theater in Washington, D.C., which already has the film listed on its website. I don't want any D.C.-based Fighting in the War Room listeners to assume it's not coming to the area and miss out. My understanding is that Roma is opening in November in New York, L.A., London, Mexico City, but will expand to other U.S. markets in early December prior to its Netflix release. So listeners in the non-New York,
Come
L.A.,
on.
United States shouldn't despair. This is a 5-star podcast, but I deducted 1 star because of the Roma misinformation. If this is read on air, which it now has been, I'll update my rating to 5 stars. Was this review helpful? Yeah, I mean, especially if you live in the D.C. area.
I wasn't even on the podcast, I want to defend the person who said this because...
It was probably me. I'm just going to...
I'm defending you, Katie. You were right, because the release is just those cities this week, and then the next week it expands to different cities, and then through December it expands to more
I actually,
until it finally arrives on Netflix. It's an actual release.
For some spoilers, I actually tracked this down, because at the time that we recorded that podcast, all we knew about was that limited release. That was this weekend.
Oh, and then the trailer came out after.
Here's where it stands officially from Netflix as of last Friday. Rome will have exclusive limited theatrical engagements starting November 21st in Los Angeles, New York, and Mexico. Additional engagements in U.S. cities, Toronto, and London will begin November 29th, with other top U.S. markets and international territories continuing to roll out beginning December 5th. So look in your local art house theaters. The dates we're looking for are the 29th and December 5th. If it's coming to you, that's when it's coming to you in a theatrical release.
But then after that, would you say there will be any Noma Roma?
Oh my God.
I think it's going to be difficult, as David pointed out on last week's episode, to elbow too much more out of the schedule with the holidays and a full release of movies coming out.
Thanks for genuinely answering that pun.
We also have a review from...
I hope that was good enough to get the record corrected. We did not mean to mislead you. Thank you for making us bring this up again.
We also have a review from Razboloman, who gives us paltry 4 stars and says, "Fun times. I really do enjoy this podcast, even when I'm not fully interested in the topic. The banter is also fun, or is so fun. I have a question for David specifically. What about Wildlife made you love it so much? Because for me, it felt very underwhelming and flat. I didn't feel any of the emotion because I didn't really feel like I know the main character. Is there something I'm missing?" Well, Razboloman, we have talked about that on this podcast. I may not have done a particularly good job articulating what it is that I loved about the movie in the event that you heard the podcast episode about that, and that's what you're trying to communicate to me now. But I did, in addition to writing a review of this movie at length, where I tried to speak to the things I like about it, I interviewed Paul Dano. One of the things we talked about was the main character and how it's not really a passive main character. The term that Dano used is active witnessing, which is really talks about how the character is sort of a screen against which all the things that he sees is going to be played against. He's very involved in the story, not just witnessing it, but doesn't always engage with what's happening in the moment. You can read both those articles on IndieWire. I hope that they help. If they don't, maybe check out our podcast episode about it if you haven't already. And if none of those convince you to give it another whirl or think about it differently, I may not be able to help you, but I appreciate you listening to the podcast all the same.
Is it Dano or Dano?
I was just going to ask this.
I believe and do say Dano.
I thought it was Dano.
Well, you pronounce Patches, love you dearly, many things wrong. So
that's true.
That's why I'm at. Hey, I'm asking for clarification.
I know. I'm saying that like you should
as
go
a follow
against
up,
your instinct.
Is it Drano or Drano?
So wait. Actually, as an additional follow up, I'm on Patches' side and have met him and said his name back to him in that way.
I
think
we've all met
asshole.
Paul Dano.
Yeah, I'm definitely in the same boat. But he's
so
nice.
So one of the Daves is just Paul. What we've learned is Paul is a very polite person who is just
Spend the rest of his life correcting how you pronounce his name.
Correct exactly. How you pronounce his name. I think that a lot of us probably are. I mean, I have a last name that's mispronounced all the time, and I have never really felt the need to correct anyone, because what good is that going to do? It just makes me feel like a jerk. But I'm sure that there is evidence out there of either he or Zoe Kazan saying his name, and that is probably...
You say potato.
Is it Zoe Kazan or Zoe Kazan?
Okay.
You say potato.
Okay, this is spiraling out of control. Go see Wildlife. It's still in theaters. Maybe you'll like it. Maybe you'll love it, and maybe you won't. Either way, you can hear us all talking about it on this show. This review was very helpful for reminding me to remind you to go do those things.
So now, unlike Roma, we're going to talk about a film that is a Netflix release and is available on Netflix everywhere right now. You do not have to figure out if it is playing in your local theater. Because, I mean, maybe it is.
But you could.
It's on Netflix. You could. You could go see it in your theater. I watch Buster Scruggs at home. I believe the vast majority of people... The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, excuse me. I watch it at home. I believe the vast majority of people will. It is the latest movie by the Coen brothers. It is a little strange to experience a new Coen brothers movie, which is kind of an event for people who care about them, just in your house by yourself and, you know, kind of watch everyone, like, slowly trickle in and tweet about it. It's you know, the Netflix effect applied to major filmmakers.
I was trying to think of the last Coen Brothers movie that I did not see in theaters. Do you by any chance know?
Oh, God.
For you? What Coen Brothers movie?
Yeah, for me. Yeah, I couldn't remember. Do you never remember, Dave? What was the last one I saw?
What did they make before...
why can't I find a list of their films?
Lady Killers must have been.
Yeah, I didn't see Lady Killers.
I didn't see Lady Killers either. I think you're right. Which was on Netflix for a long time. Anyway, back to the Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Yeah, so it's an interesting Netflix film because it's an anthology film. It would have been a very odd experience in theaters, I think, because it's, I believe, six different stories that go over a little over 2 hours. There's movie stars in basically every single one of them. They're all set in the Old West. They're all vaguely related to death and, you know, cynical attitudes toward death, which is kind of a Coen Brothers staple. I don't know if there's any other greater theme that I would come up with off the top of my head, though maybe one of you guys would.
Life.
life and death.
Coen's play. I do think that one of the things I find really beautiful about the fifth segment, I can't remember what it's called at the top of my head, something about a dog.
The gal who got rattled.
The gal got rattled, right, not about the dog. Certainly with a dog, is very much a counterpoint to, I think, the other five segments, in that it really focuses on the value of life and living in the here and now and what we can do with the time given to us, even if it always ends in the same way.
Misery, tragedy, blood.
But Katie, please go on.
I kind of feel like I want to be sold on Buster Scruggs because I got really worn out really quickly by the violence. I think it's as Coen movies go, it feels more violent. It feels more bloody than anything they've made in a long time. Like, even No Country for Old Men, like, had violence, but it was kind of spare, and like you didn't have to. It was, you know, artfully done in a way. I mean, the first one, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, is Tim Roth as this singing cowboy who's hilarious,
parading
around the Old West. I'm sorry, not Tim Roth. Tim Blake Nelson. I always do that weirdly. Tim Blake Nelson. Kind of parading around the Old West in this white suit and then brutally killing people and then singing songs about it. And it's funny and uncomfortable, which is the way the Coens do a lot of violence. But then it's followed up by more violent stories and then more violent stories. And then the one with Liam Neeson that's like both violent and like horribly cruel.
Well, there's an arc
and the one, and the gal that got rattled.
That's the third story. I think there is a trajectory to this where that it starts with a certain cartoonish violence to the Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is very cartoonish. And all the blood in this movie is done with, like, very obvious CG, which I wish I had the opportunity to ask the Coen Brothers about, because it's a strange choice. What do you mean? Do I think so?
There's a lot of, like, blood splattering onto wood paneling, and I don't know if that's...
I don't know what they used once the blood interacted with other substances, but just watching clips again this weekend,
and it's very obviously
CG. It was shot digitally. It's their first digital
movie.
Which
is a first, right?
Netflix,
their first digital. Wow. Yeah,
that feels pronounced.
I don't want to lose my point that I was trying to make.
Okay, sorry.
Which is that there's a trajectory to these stories that they start sort of silly, and then the next one's a little bit more serious, and then it really bottoms out with the Liam Neeson one in the middle. And then I think sort of – and that's the most cynical and – despairing of them all, and then it sort of climbs out of the hole as it goes along. I mean, there is a bit of an upside to the one with Tom Waits that follows, where he's panning for gold and this idyllic valley that no one else seems to have discovered. And then there's the one with Zoe Kazan and Bill Heck that we just mentioned. And then the last segment is more of a summation than anything else, but with a sort of wicked positivity to it as well. I don't know. I do think that there's an arc there that's worth paying attention to.
Yeah, there's definitely an arc to it. It's just a lot of, like, once you get to that bottoming out with the Liam Neeson one, it's a lot to climb back out of it. And I thought the Zoe Kazan one, The Girl Who Got Rattled, I really enjoyed that one. It also has brutality to it. I mean, I guess we can have a spoiler section to this conversation.
I guess.
But it did make me feel, and I think a lot of people talk about the Coens that they feel a little sucker punch because the Coens do this thing where they show you violence, they let you enjoy the violence, and then kind of tisk you for enjoying it and kind of ask you what it means that you were enjoying this at all. And I did feel that way about that one in particular, in a way that I don't often from Coen movies, where I just kind of felt like dragged along. And I know that the Old West was brutal and a horrible place to live, and God knows it made me glad I didn't live in the Old West. But I kept thinking about True Grit, which was violent and kind of had all these tough talking characters and had this like very unlikely 15-year-old who could speak poetry, but had this kind of soul to it that I felt like I lacked in Buster Scruggs overall.
Well, I mean, they're two very different movies because True Grit feels like an actual story of history of living characters, whereas this feels folklore-ish, or, you know, this is a movie, and it feels very pronounced to be a movie, and I think it works as a digitally shot movie, too. But the intro, the Buster Scruggs segment, really sets the tone with the hyper colors, hyper violence, and cartoonish characters. But I find all of, you know, it's the drip down from that. Even when it gets grimier, even when it gets starker, it's still a movie. It's still a tale. And I don't know. I kind of went along with it. Each, you know, they're all parables. It's like reading the flipping through the Bible or something. How they flip through the beginning of the book, and it's all heightened. I see True Grit in this in like totally different buckets of what the Coens are doing. And I think the most interesting thing to talk about when we talk about all these segments and what's the through line is the idea, this kind of meta narrative that has come out with the Coens doing interviews for this movie, where they've mentioned that they've written these segments over the entire course of their career, it sounds like, and wasn't sure how they'd like finally tie them together, and they decided to just kind of throw them into an anthology movie. And it does feel like this kind of culmination of everything they've wrestled with. They've wrestled with violence, they've wrestled with greed and man's desires, and how it always backfires in their face. But it also feels like a Hail Caesar to me. It feels like a movie's movie, and about how we deal with all this stuff on screen and in our stories, in our oral traditions. And it's unique in that way.
Yeah, I mean, of course, like anything the Coen brothers would make, it's very much in conversation with the genre that it's playing with. I mean, I think that a lot of this you see is a very active response to the Westerns of various times. But I think also, Katie, it's never been my experience with the Coen brothers, and this is not to invalidate, you know, what you felt about watching this, but I've never had the feeling that they were rubbing our nose in that. I mean, I think sometimes they've
seen that criticism, though, right?
I don't know. I mean, they moralize in a way, I think, where they do occasionally raise false hope, which is something that you were tapping into, where they're like some order to the universe that they then destabilize because they see it as sort of chaotic and random, not quite nihilistic, but like just that the finality of it all, death comes for everyone, and so on.
Can't stop what's coming.
You can't stop what's coming. I mean, it's very – there's a feeling – my first comment after seeing this movie was that once and for all, it sort of settles in my mind that the character that they most identified with in No Country for Old Men was Anton Chigurh. And, you know, it was just sort of incidental that that – what's the name of the character that Josh Brolin plays? I know it. I can't get
it. Not Lewin. Llewellyn.
Llewellyn.
Llewellyn Moss.
Llewellyn Moss, right. That he – it's just sort of incidental that he's the hero. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's – a dark film, but I did, as I was saying earlier, I mean, I do think that there is a bit of hope there. I mean, hope's probably not the right word, but there's like a fullness in what these people are able to do in their lives and find like some purpose for themselves, even if the outcome is always the same. And the bleakest segment here has really stuck with me. I mean, I liked watching this movie. I saw it on the big screen, on a very big screen at the New York Film Festival. And have only watched bits and pieces on Netflix, but this movie has really stuck with me in the month plus since I've seen it. The Liam Neeson section in particular is really.
Let's talk about that a little.
Let's describe people in case people haven't seen this. So this is the third segment. It's called Meal Ticket, and it stars Liam Neeson and this other guy I'm not familiar with, and I'm not sure if this is a CG. Effect, or if this actor is actually limbless, but he does not have arms.
He's limbless.
Or
legs. He's Dursley from Harry Potter.
Yeah, he's Dudley Dursley.
Dudley Dursley.
Why would I possibly
I
recognize
learned that
him
from that? The New Yorker's review of this movie. So
the Dursley boy is very plump, and this guy is not. So
he is grown
forgive
up.
Me for not recognizing him. Liam Neeson is trucking him around because he does not have limbs, but he is a phenomenal actor. So he goes to town to recite Mary Shelley's Ozymandias, the story of Cain and Abel, Shakespeare. He recites Lincoln's
Gettysburg
Address. Yeah, he is just performing, and Liam Neeson is there I don't know, to make thunder on a piece of metal at the right time and like help him piss on the off hours. It's a brutal existence. And eventually he finds maybe a way out of this, or he, something to do with a chicken. I was trying to, this flew by me, exactly what the chicken that he ends up buying does. It like picks numbers out of a,
you it like adds and subtracts, like you tell it a math problem and it solves it and then picks the right number.
It's a great sideshow bit.
It's very reminiscent of the chicken and the way that Werner Herzog uses the chicken and Stroycek. I don't know,
but anyway, I don't think we should get too spoilery, but it takes a very dark turn about what Liam Neeson wants to do with his life and how he gets to accomplish it with this, the baggage. Is it his brother?
I don't know.
I got the impression that they were related. But,
who, he and the guy?
Yeah.
Oh, I did not get that impression at all. I don't think that Liam Neeson's character has, even if it's Killer Be Killed in the West, that he has any sort of pre-existing emotional connection to him. I think he looks at that guy as a meal ticket, you know, for the title. And you know, nothing beyond that.
That's fair. It takes a dark turn.
We should not go too deep into plot details, both because this is a short segment and we don't want to spoil for people.
But why has that stuck with you so much, David? I mean, it's a stark ending. It's a great little short story. I found all of these segments to be really fulfilling and enjoyable, but maybe a little shallow or at least blunt in their metaphors. The following segment to Meal Ticket is Tom Waits getting, you know, panning for gold and destroying this idyllic landscape. And like,
unpopular
this is so
opinion,
blunt.
That's my least favorite segment.
Really? Interesting. Yeah. I mean, it's a beautiful, this whole movie is just so stunning. I watched it at home too on Netflix, and it's still like such a beautiful movie.
Yeah, but the gloss of it all is, like, again, an interesting choice.
It's like
much
a dream.
Like the CG blood, but it's not one that I...
It's not...
Maybe I will come to appreciate it on you know, conceptual grounds going forward, as I revisit it, as I think about it deeper. Aesthetically, not into it.
Fair. But yeah, it's the colors and the digital cinematography of this movie are as blunt as the parables and the metaphors at times. But in contrast, Meal Ticket, I think, I don't know, gets you deep. But why did it strike you?
Yeah, it's also the aesthetically the darkest of any of them. Yeah. It's very where the White Walkers live in Game of Thrones sort of aesthetic.
It looks like most like
Mrs.
Bruno
Miller's Slab of the West.
It reminds me Bruno Del Bonnell shot the movie, and it looks like his Harry Potter movie a little bit. It has really muted colors, and it's interesting.
All right, let David answer your questions.
Yeah, well, I want.
It's a very good question. I wish I had a good answer to it. I mean, I think it's just the you know, to quote again Josh Brolin in the short he made for the Coen Brothers for that can omnibus film. There's a heck of a lot of truth in that segment here. It just felt very unsparing and honest. And there's something, I mean, the Coens are well known for their gallows humor. And there is some very literal gallows humor in this movie, which made me laugh very loud in the James Franco segment, which I thought was brilliant. I mean, I think that is as close to a perfect short film as anything in here. Or that I've seen recently. It's that 8 or 10 minutes, however long it is. But that's one of the shorter ones. But I think there's just the way that, and I don't know if we need a spoiler segment. I just like the way that the guy, the main guy in Meal Ticket, looks at the chicken. It's just like it's just so. It all rings so true about the ruthlessness of it all. Being able to sort of see your own fate and connect the dots and be powerless to stop what's coming.
Are you worried about being replaced by a chicken? Is that it?
I think it's a metaphor for media.
I mean, it is in a way.
I mean, we all
feel
that, right?
Of all the things the Coens care about, the fate of media cannot possibly be on their list.
All right, chicken. Tom Hardy's going to play Venom. Pull something out of the hat.
The chicken clicks.
$80 million. Jesus Christ.
The chicken clicks. You're out, David. The chicken's in.
And Liam Neeson's so good, and that kid is so Henry good. Mueling is his name. Henry, that kid.
Mueling,
I mean,
I think.
I'm now realizing that he's probably like not older.
Let's
I don't know.
Wrap
how old is
this.
Anyway, this is a movie I was not I'm wary of anthology movies. I've never really seen an anthology movie that I think is strong throughout. I think by definition they are, or by nature there are highs and lows. But I think this is as cohesive as any of the ones I've seen. And
I really like the book that they use. I think that's a big part of it. Is that strange? That
what's that?
The book that they use, the framing device, yeah, is actually what really makes this movie 29. Feel like an idea, like an anthology that makes sense. And it feels the cohesion that you're talking about, David, like flipping the pages, getting to read little bits. Like, I wonder how much Ethan Coen wrote of this book, because the pages are so alive and the art that they have, like that prop is perfect and makes this movie so, it really gels it together.
I'm with you on that. I just, the level of cynicism and the way that it approached the world wore me out in the end. Although I do want to watch the last segment again, because I felt like I was kind of ready for the movie to be over at that point, but there's a lot being thrown around in that last one, and then you also have Jefferson Mays singing, which is delightful. So I would like to revisit that one. The rest of it may not ever make it onto my Coen's rewatches.
Yeah, I think it's a deceptively major entry in their canon, and we'll be going back to it for a while.
I feel like that's a conversation that happens with every Coen's movie comes out. There's like half people are like, minor, yeah, and everyone else is like, nope, major, and then the debate goes on.
I think you are 10,000% right, and I'm sure that if you went back in time, I would be saying exactly the same thing for Hail Caesar, about which I also believe that is true.
I just hope Tim Blake Nelson sings in the next Coen Brothers movie as well.
That would be great.
All right, chicken. Johnny Depp's an evil wizard.
The chicken clicks. The chicken clicks.
Aren't you gonna come along? Aren't you gonna fight? Aren't you gonna hold your hands up to the light? If you feel an emptiness, if you want to hide, think about the blood that's pumping, keeping you alive. We've got it all worked out.
So, this weekend, we saw the return of the Fantastic Beasts franchise, which is the Wizarding World franchise, which is the remnants of Harry Potter. Warner Brothers, of course, is all in on J.K. Rowling's five-film anthology, or six films. There's three additional films to the two that are out. That's five. I can add. Five movies.
The chicken
story
can add, Dave.
Yeah, the chicken can also add. See, everybody's just in competition with the chicken. That's my goal. Have better opinions than a chicken. It's actually kind of fitting for this movie, which continues to try to smash together the two parallel stories of Newt Scamander, guy who can't make a decision, and Grindelwald, the person we eventually know has a showdown with Dumbledore that is very detailed in the final book, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, but sort of gets glossed over in the movies in favor of Voldemort, who is the key protagonist, which is great because apparently J.K. Rowling has decided that in this series she's going to rewrite history somewhat similar to her Harry Potter and the Cursed Child play, which she contributed the story for. Both of those post-Potter tales have circled around the suffering of a child and that child's greater place in the wizarding world. Not to spoil too much of the crimes of... Yeah,
I think we should spoil the whole movie.
Yeah, been spoiled for me, and I endorse that idea.
So, if you haven't seen the movie, turn away now, because I think that this segment is best served by completely spoiling the ending and then talking about how it destroys Harry Potter canon.
If you haven't seen the movie, just keep listening and don't see the movie.
Yeah, that's kind of my plan.
People can make their own decision there. So, Dave,
you can come back and watch it when part four comes out and whatever, that we get to the point of all of this. It's revealed
there's canon
that,
busting.
Ezra Miller's credence is actually Dumbledore. Aurelius Dumbledore.
Go ahead.
Not the Dumbledore. Aurelius Dumbledore, the thus far unmentioned brother of Albus Dumbledore, which doesn't make sense because Dumbledore's dad went to Azkaban, where he eventually died, and Dumbledore's mother was famously blown up by Dumbledore's sister. I mean, there's a way that I could make this make sense in my mind with Harry Potter mythology, and it has a lot to do with the... So now in Fantastic Beasts, much like in Harry Potter before it, there's a bunch of prophecies that they refer to as poems that lead them down this completely red herring soap opery plot twist with the Lestrange family. But basically this could be applying to the Dumbledore family in the idea that they sort of created Credence to take the burden of the Obscurious off the daughter, maybe. Anyway, it's weird.
But so what
Fox the Phoenix shows up as like Credence's fucking Phoenix now, and he's on the bad guy side with Grindelwald. Nagini the snake is included in this movie as a Korean woman completely unnecessarily, because she's on the good person's side when this ends, but doesn't play an active point in the story. The biggest crime that Fantastic Beasts 2 pulls is that J.K. Rowling has been allowed to become a screenwriter, but has somehow violated the primary rule of all dramatic arts, which is that each scene needs to have a purpose in the plot that you're telling.
Oh, boy.
There are weird scenes in this movie. For example, there's a scene where the Muggle guy is watching this passed-out wizard, who we later learn is on an unbreakable vow. Doesn't matter. He's passed out. Muggle guy's alone in this house. He's bumbling around the house, being all wondering about the magic things, and then he runs into Nicholas Flamel, who's like an old guy, and there's a joke about how he's old, and because you've seen the Harry Potter movies, you know that Nicholas Flamel has the Philosopher's Stone, blah blah blah. I mean, they show it to you, but the joke is that you're supposed to know beforehand. And then
Sorcerer's Stone, this is America.
Yeah, sorry. Anyway, so he and the Muggle guy look into a crystal ball, which shows him the climax of the movie you're watching, and the Muggle guy's like, oh no, I need to get there. He turns around, the guy he's watching has disappeared, and the Muggle guy's like, oh, I was supposed to watch him. Doesn't matter, though, I need to go save the day, and then goes off. Then Nicholas Flamel goes to a book, and he's like, I'm also going to this location. All three of those people end up at the same location at vaguely the same time. What is that scene's fucking purpose? The entire movie is all of those scenes, like, piled on top of each other with no rhyme or reason, except maybe to show you some cool CG trickery or to have a, like, little spot of the Harry Potter score. I hope this is the, like, divot in the storytelling talents of the Fantastic Beasts arc or whatever it is, because this one's, like, getting by just on fumes of being interested in the wizarding world. If you like magic and stuff, this movie will pull you through 2 hours and 15 minutes, and you'll kind of barely notice. But then when it ends, as the guy who was sitting next to me in the theater said, that was dumb, let's go. And then that was I was like, yeah,
to quote a great man.
Did he say that to you, or just like in general?
Where do you want me to go?
He said that to the person he was with. He was talking basically throughout the entire movie, which is usually bad at a draft house, but his observations were usually very positive and like, oh yeah, fuck yeah. But then like at the end, it was just the final line of the movie that it reveals he's a Dumbledore. He says, that's dumb, let's go. Ezra Miller blows up a mountain in the movie. So
I don't want to harp on this too much, but to wrap this mini segment up, I don't understand why Harry Potter fans are flipping out about this reveal. What does it actually change? Just because it wasn't mentioned in any previous book, people are pissed off?
I guess so. It's sort of a rewriting of the Dumbledore family story to put it in line with the Harry Potter mythos. I can't say what's pissing people off in general. Like, sometimes it might be like weird continuity things. For me, it seems really weird to have spent so many movies revealing that Dumbledore was sort of a selfish asshole who kept putting children in danger, to then flash back to a prequel series where we have to learn that lesson again. This movie doesn't contribute anything. It just tells us more what we already knew, and then throws in a twist that might be a lie, or that doesn't matter if it is true, because we know where this all ends up. We know Neville beheads Nagini, the sweet Korean woman, when she turns into a snake. And, like, that sort of stuff is all in the future. that's the problem with Cursed Child, is they have to mess with time travel in order to have consequence but still retread the Harry Potter story. I'm afraid this one's heading in the same direction.
Sounds like it's already there.
One question, and we can wrap it up. How's Jude Law?
Jude Law's great. If this was sold as just Dumbledore and Grindelwald and we didn't have to deal with Fantastic Beasts and Newt Scamander, then yes, I would see that prequel series. I feel kind of like lied to that I now have to spend half of each movie with Fantastic Beasts when obviously this is the core part of the story.
Can I ask a question that I saw raised on Twitter? I can't remember by whom. So Jude Law in this movie, young Dumbledore, is dressing as a dapper gentleman, I'm told. I've seen from these screenshots, he seems to be in like a three-piece suit.
Sure.
But the Dumbledore that I know wears flowing wizard robes and like giant wizard hats. Is there any indication that you could see in this movie of what provoked Dumbledore's change in fashion from like young and dapper to crazy old wizard?
Comfort.
I would say maybe World War II.
How young and dapper are you feeling these days, David? Doesn't a wizard robe sound great?
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah. I'm wearing a wizard's robe right now.
It's a snuggie.
Also, what they do to the like old Hogwarts wizarding robes, I don't approve of that design either. They look like they were made by Adidas. Fuck that shit.
They were. Someone's got to make them.
Good old 1920s Adidas. Yeah.
All day anyway, I dream about sorcery.
Crimes of Grindelwald. You know what? This movie is going to be a great, like Age of Ultron before it. Buy it in the 10-movie Blu-ray pack in Christmas 2028. You'll totally enjoy watching it in between other things. Walk you to the counter. What you got to offer? Pick you out a soda. Look at you forever. Walk you to the water. Eyes like a casino. You ain't bone typical. Piece of silver, pretty as a diagram. Go down to the Rio, put it in my left hand. Put it in a fruit machine. Everyone's a winner, laughing like a seagull.
So, to go back to the last point for a second, I'm still mad at this entire franchise for replacing Colin Farrell from the first movie with Johnny Depp at the last minute, which robbed us of him and Jude Law as like feuding wizards who also love each other, which just is the franchise that I want to watch. But lucky for Colin Farrell, he wound up in something better, which is Widows. He's one of many, many, many people in Widows, also including Liam Neeson of The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. It is out in theaters this weekend. As I understand, it didn't do great. I haven't looked at the box office.
Are we worried? The narrative is that it didn't do great.
It's hard to imagine it would have done great.
Well,
it doesn't seem like a big movie.
I think that it is going to have a decent multiplier. It's going to stick around in theaters for a long time because it'll pick up some nominations.
Ooh, a multiplier. Look at you, box office mojo. Get your box office mojo going.
I know a word. It could do decently internationally. I think that no one is going to get in trouble for this movie. I do think it's the kind of movie that it bodes so well for the world, for the industry, for people in general. If it were a huge hit, it would say good things about the response to adult-driven, you know, movies. Not original movies. It's based on a television show.
With great actors in them.
With great actors, but...
original enough. Like, yeah. I mean, Steve McQueen loved the Widows TV series in Britain. I'm not sure that it is... Like, no one was trying to build a franchise off of it before Steve McQueen said he wanted to.
But I think it's probably too early, and there really isn't there aren't the numbers there to say that it was a bomb.
All right, well, let's not talk about box office. We should definitely have a spoiler segment for this, but we'll start talking vaguely enough. It is a heist thriller. It is about a group of widows led by Viola Davis whose husbands are killed in a robbery gone wrong, and they decide for their own various financial reasons, mostly, to carry out their own heist inspired by some plans left behind so that they can basically pay off their husband's debts and move on with their lives. Viola Davis is the ringleader. Michelle Rodriguez and Elizabeth Debicki are the other two widows. Cynthia Erivo eventually joins them in their scheme. She's a babysitter who runs really fast, which I guess is probably a good quality for being a babysitter.
She runs so well. It's crazy. She's like Tom Cruise.
She runs very quickly.
No, she true. I really want to see her and Tom Cruise. Like
they have this similar race. Form.
It's like yeah, it's very, like very stiff, yeah. very upright, but like so fast. There's
it's
also
like
track political aspect,
right? It's not just. Oh, sorry, I'm stuck
on
the running.
I'm sure. I'm curious about. I wonder if she had a running trainer. Because, you know, she's a Broadway star, so she's, like, her physicality is good. But like,
how has that interview not been done on Vanity Fair?
Sorry. True.
Put it on
I
the
keep
site.
Pitching things that I should I make articles. There's a political angle to all of this that maybe it's probably not worth getting into, but they are tangled up for various reasons with both Colin Farrell's character, who is kind of this white Chicago politician who wants to represent this largely black district, and then this character played by Brian Tyree Henry, who is a black aspiring politician but also criminal who was running against him. His brothers, Daniel Kaluuya, the brothers, right?
They're brothers.
Memory serves. I haven't seen the movie since Toronto, but I think
I'm looking that up. I'm going to look that. Oh yes, they are brothers. They are the Manning brothers.
Yes,
and they are.
And Daniel Kaluuya is kind of his muscle and
oh my God.
Owner of the most intimidating eyes.
Speaking
you've
of
ever
Anton
seen in your life.
Sugar, I mean he is.
Yes, that's exactly what I thought of during the movie. Yeah. I mean, it's that intense, and it's that he walks in a room, and it's like the angel of death has arrived. It's totally
Daniel Kaluuya's his. I mean, he's played other roles, but like. Get Out to Black Panther to Widows is a pretty tremendous run for an actor who I did not know before.
Yeah.
Get
Out.
But Widows is kind of a tremendous run for every single person in it. Carrie Coon is in like three scenes and she's incredible.
Underused.
In it.
That's my big beef with the movie is that the character
that's your hot take.
Does not do right by that character.
It doesn't do right by the character. I mean, I think the character makes sense. I don't know if Carrie Coon needed to be
the character movie. Makes
well. How about
sense.
How about Jackie Weaver, David? Jackie Weaver has like two lines.
Oh, I forgot Jackie Weaver's
and an Oscar nom.
But the character makes sense. I think that I could have used another scene or two of her. But
Jackie
for me,
Weaver.
The standout in this movie, other than Cynthia Erivo, who rules and also rules hard in Bad Times at the El Royale. In which she
but gets only
to
the
sing
six
a lot.
Of us who saw that no
right but we all appreciated her in that is one of the world's greatest living actresses, the only person in this cast who's had a run I think as strong as Daniel Kaluuya, Elizabeth Debicki, all 6 foot nine of her around all she is so fucking good, every scene incredible, so good.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even like. So we want to get into a spoiler segment. We don't want to spoil it too much. There are just so many massive. Sorry, we don't want to spoil it too much before we get there. There's just so many massive pleasures to be had in this movie, and like
yes,
not only the
yes.
twists, which we'll get to, which are just like wondrous to see in a theater, but all the performances. Like I'm sitting here thinking, like, okay, Elizabeth Debicki is great, but also Daniel Kaluuya is great, and also Viola Davis. Even though like I watched enough How to Get Away with Murder to feel like I had a sense of her as like a steely, like badass doing immoral things.
I've never
but,
seen
like,
an episode. If I loved Widows, should I move on
no,
to that?
It's so much dumber than Widows, okay. and will frustrate you.
But does she get to roar like she does in this? Because I was surprised how she felt like powerful as you're describing, but still kind of understated and not the beating heart of this movie. That it's really balanced between all of these characters and all these plates spinning in the air. And she's not as like dominant as I expected, but she certainly roars in a way. I mean, I keep thinking about Widows in terms of Heat. So many people adore Heat for that action scene, and that's what they think of when they think of Heat. And Widows
not
is like
the diner scene,
right? Well, the Widows is like the diner scene is like the whole movie, or the dialogue is finally the whole movie.
Well, I don't want to blow us talking about the diner scene because the.
I meant the diner scene in Heat, where like
yeah, no, I know. I'm just saying there's
upcoming, a good diner scene in Widows too.
No, but Mary Queen of Scots, when we get to talking about that, is the diner scene comparison to make.
Really,
this fall
Wait,
season,
Queen Elizabeth goes to a diner.
Yeah,
no, the whole movie is structured like in the same way that Heat is around this one meeting between its two central figures. It was explicitly modeled after the diner scene in Heat, and if we're gonna talk about that scene, I'd rather. Save it for when it's okay. most pertinent, even though Widows
thanks, for, thanks
much.
For your insider info, insider Dave, David, Box Office Mojo, Multiplier Dave.
But Widows is a much better movie, so let's say good things about Widows.
Well, what I really meant by the diner scene is just like all of the dialogue in Heat and all of the dynamics, like character first crime picture as opposed to the fetishization of Heat's action sequence that like Nolan, who constantly brings up Heat, is always talking about. This is a movie where Katie, you mentioned earlier that there's like a political streak here. It can't be overlooked. It can't be glossed over. The socio-political elements of Widows is what makes this movie come alive to me, where obviously they're launching a heist, but the heist is really what, 10 minutes of the movie? It's not a big part of it. You get to see them train for this. You get to see them try and figure out how these women with no crime experience are going to pull this off. And that's
there's
interesting.
There's lots of like mini heists of like going and casing a place or getting guns. Sure.
There's definitely
like,
Ocean's 11 operational
know how they're gonna pull
homework.
This. They're the only people with the balls to pull this off.
This is true. This is true.
They don't think they have the balls to do it.
But I'm surprised that this movie really feels like Steve McQueen, who directed the movie and co-wrote the script, but he co-wrote it with Gillian Flynn from Gone Girl, and it really feels like the two of them fused together. Like, McQueen's observations about gentrification in Chicago and the politics element of this is so important to how the heist functions and the class warfare and why these women. Somebody saw the movie at my office leading up to opening weekend at a screening or something and came to me and they're like, you don't really buy this plot, right? That these women would try and do this. Like, it doesn't make any sense. Why wouldn't they try and hire someone? They have no experience. I don't know. I felt the weight of this, of their lives crumbling, and the men, these toxic men, these disgusting men who take advantage of them, and the city that takes advantage of them, and the fire that would drive them to do this. I bought it all, and I think it's all kind of wound together. It's really cohesive, and the political is an important part of that, to make the heist feel really the pressure, the tension. It has to be
also
a politically motivated thing.
The whole point of a heist movie, like, it doesn't always have to be like absurd like Fast Five, but like, you know, the heist is coming. Like, I don't like it's all leading there. Like, it doesn't matter to me if I really think these people would do it. They're gonna do it. They're there, you know? Like, and I think you're totally right, Pat, is that like you feel the forces that lead them there, but that just feels like such a weird complaint to have about this movie. Sorry,
yeah.
Coworker.
No, I think that they were skeptical. And the movie addresses this problem, so they're extra off about this read. I think they were skeptical about kind of women with no experience pulling this off. And that's because it's like a male-coded thing, because we've seen male expert criminals try and pull off a heist at the beginning of the movie, that it feels especially odd that these women, especially Elizabeth Debicki, who is tall and frail and like, is she going to be able to do this? Yeah. But then they put in that scene where you see them running with the bags of money. What a brilliant scene where you're like, this is the weight of a pack of hundreds. This is the weight of a pack of, if it's 50s, and it's like twice as much. And it's like, oh my God, you really have to like haul ass with this giant bag of money. And that scene says so much about like, so, this is a real thing that we're going to pull off. And this is how much might it takes. And this is if you're in the middle of somebody's compound and the guards catch you and you're running down the block with a bag of money, here's how it will feel on you. I thought that was really effective.
So I remember once upon a time before I had seen anything that had been adapted from her books, that the rap on Gillian Flynn was that she wrote like beach trash.
She wrote for Entertainment Weekly, which is beach magazine trash.
Well, no, sure. Just... But I meant,
wow.
But no, it's a relative
chicken
detail because now that I have seen and loved Gone Girl and Widows and was really impressed with Sharp Objects, I'm trying to wonder, you know, if the beat on her books was earned, if her screenwriting is much stronger than her novels, if there was an element of misogyny to the critical rap on her, what that the story was there, if anyone has any sense.
I mean, I think a combination of all of those things. Like, I've read her three big books. I think Gone Girl, the movie, better than Gone Girl, the books. But I've also read like some of the Gone Girl, the book is pretty good. I think just Gone Girl, the movie's great. And it's so similar to the book. But like some of the Gone Girl knockoffs that have been published since then are so terrible that it makes you really appreciate her. She's got really a great sense of prose, which I think translates to her sense of dialogue. Like the political aspects of Widows aren't really present in her books as far as I remember. They're also really dark and kind of bravely dark, which you would know if you've seen Sharp Objects. So I think the whole beach trash thing is because they were really compelling to read. And I think it happens with any book that becomes like a big deal. Like, you know, people would like roll their eyes at The Goldfinch because it was like the book everyone was reading for a while, or The Corrections, which is like not a beach trash book.
Who's directing The Goldfinch? Why am I wary about this?
The guy who did Brooklyn, I thought.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I feel like that's going to be interesting. Anyway, people should be less snobby about books. That's my hot take.
I think it might have to do with twists too. Like once you get a big twist, your novel automatically becomes page turner garbage or something. It gets dumped. And I worry about Widows too. I actually haven't read too many reviews of this movie. I'm not sure where it's sitting on the old Rotten Tomato meter. But I could imagine some people thinking it's schlocky because it gets pretty twisty. And maybe I'm teeing up our spoiler section.
Yeah,
here,
should we go into spoilers? Just tell everyone to go see Widows. It's fucking.
Yeah,
fast.
I mean, are we all on the same page, David? I guess I don't really know. You saw it a while ago, but were you as wowed? I was totally bowled over, I guess, is where I'm going.
Yeah,
with this.
Every
second
really,
was satisfying to me.
Of all the films that I saw in that, you know, blitz of fall movies that we go and see at these festivals in quick succession, Widows and Suspiria are the two that I really, really want to see again, for different reasons, although I like them both very much. But Widows, yeah, I had a blast with Widows. Big fan.
Yeah, I saw it in Toronto too, so it's been a while, but I just remember sitting next to a total stranger who was like guffawing and giggling and like having the best time of his life watching it, which made it so much fun for me to watch. And then just walking out of the movie, just wanted to talk about Widows the whole time. Like I was so excited about it, which when you're in the middle of a festival, if you're seeing so many movies a day, is a great feeling to hold on to. So
didn't this movie like not play well at a festival? I don't know, Telluride or something?
I feel like it played later in Toronto. People were like, like I don't know. It's like I think people were trying to write it off as being shallow because it's so fun.
Yes, exactly.
Which
is the Gillian Flynn conundrum.
Yeah, that's actually really true. But let's get into spoilers and talk about why it's not shallow.
Okay.
Date ring spoiler gong.
Ding dong. So Katie, I gasped twice in this movie. Like jaw on the floor. Holy shit. I was so happy. The movie got me. And I'm going to spoil it right here in case people haven't flipped ahead or whatever, or paused or bailed.
I assume we're going to do these in chronological order.
Yes. Number one, jaw hits the floor. Harry is alive.
Liam Neeson's alive.
He's alive. He didn't
his
die.
Dog found him.
He's cheating on his wife, Viola Davis, with one of the other widows.
He had a baby with Carrie Coon.
That is fucked. Man.
Yeah, that twist was
because
I'm a sucker for plots in general. Like I'm always fooled by them. And that was one where the guy sitting next to me like gasped and laughed, and the audience gasped in unison when I saw it. It was so fun.
And I think it's really satisfying because they do such a. McQueen and Flynn do such a good job of building up the relationship in the movie, like that. Correct me if I'm wrong, the first shot of this movie is a sloppy-ass romantic kiss in bed between Veronica, Viola Davis's character, and Harry, Liam Neeson. Like, it's so romantic and gross, and I'm like, I love this. They are a really in-love couple, and of course he's going to die. Like, you see that coming. Something bad's going to happen.
Well, the movie's called Widows.
It's called Widows! Hey, it's a title! And then you learn about their son. And the way that that slow drips into the movie, I think, is incredibly, I mean, satisfying is a strange way to put it, maybe. But it's, like, dark. It's deeply felt. And the kind of, like, social angle of his death, that he was murdered by a policeman while he was driving
his dad's
red car.
He's a half-black teenager killed by a cop.
Yeah.
Stopped driving his car.
And, like, that is blunt force of, you know, I didn't necessarily see that coming either, but as soon as you see him in the car, you know what's going to happen, and maybe it's on the nose, but it was so intense and real. And so you feel bad for Harry, and then all of a sudden, like, I think you actually get the total reveal of his death after this twist, after Harry is a total scumbag who's cheating on his wife, had another kid, and then you get more sympathetic with Harry because you see how he lost his kid, and maybe this all makes sense in this insane universe. But then, the second twist, he comes back in the room after Veronica has accomplished the heist, and my jaw hit the floor when I knew he was out there in the world, but I didn't expect him to just kind of like walk back into her life like the way that they did. And for
like
her
in this
just,
moment of triumph and where you're catching your breath.
Yes, because I was so satisfied by the heist. But there he is right there, right at the end, just to be a total asshole again and ruin everything. And for her to get that satisfying, like, the killer John Woo moment to shoot him. Blew my mind. I loved every second of it. But did the twist work for you guys? I mean, what is this movie hitting the highs? I hope I sound elated because I loved it.
Yeah.
I'm just gonna say very quickly. Yes, David.
It worked for me. I'm not someone, I've probably said this on this podcast before, who is very good at guessing the sort of thing because I try, maybe just because I'm not good at it, but also I try not to do that while I'm watching something. I don't really enjoy thinking about movies that way while I'm watching them. I was not at all surprised that Liam Neeson was alive. I was like, yeah, of course. It's Liam Neeson. He's not going to be in just like 4 minutes of the movie in the beginning.
No, but the way that they were doling him out in this kind of silent role, I thought, yeah, that makes sense.
That's the point of the Jackie Weaver too, is that you have her in there in this tiny role and she's not involved. So it's like, okay, so this movie just has really famous people in really tiny parts. I totally bought that he was dead.
Jackie Weaver, really famous.
Yeah,
she did the Taken movies.
But I don't really care that I wasn't like jaw on the floor. I didn't really have any jaw on the floor moments like that just did, but I don't really care.
Even Daniel Kaluuya killing multiple people didn't blow your mind.
But I had the thrill. I got the thrill out of these moments all the same, even if I wasn't surprised by them, because I think what the movie is doing with the reveal that he's still alive is to sort of reorient even the tall Irish white guy as a product of his socioeconomic circumstances. And like, you know, even I think Daniel Kaluuya's character is shaped by the world being stacked against him because of who he is and what he looks like and where he's from. And I think the movie is very conscious of the fact that all the choices that these characters are being made because of the reactive to their place in the world. And then you're trying to be proactive to better their station and restore some sense of justice. And I think that the movie is smart to, once it applies that thinking to one character, applies it to all characters. I think it all pans out. They're very good about that from start to finish, and it's very satisfying, even if I don't remember every beat. But I do love in heist movies not remembering every beat, because that means that every time I watch Ocean's 11 on TV, which is quite frequent, there's always one part of their plan. It always changes what this part is, but there's always one part that I forget. And I'm like, wait a second, how does this all add up? And that's what keeps me watching. And then I'm like, oh, right. Yeah. So.
I also look forward to seeing Widows again and like having forgotten some of the plot details and what I need to piece together. I mean, the heist itself, I think, Patch, as you were saying, like how it's really satisfying, but also really short. We also haven't mentioned Robert Duvall yet. He's in it.
I don't know if I want to register Robert Duvall. The one off thing about this movie for me, he might not be well. He might not be well. Is that rude?
Wow.
I'm now worried about Robert Duvall, and I wasn't before. He's very old now. He's a little off in this movie.
Colin Farrell's great, though.
He's pretty great in this. I love all the political and like running for alderman of Southside. I don't know what an alderman does. Can you tell me?
It's basically a city council member, isn't it?
It just seems like based on how big this election is in the movie, it just doesn't seem like a very big job. But I guess they're securing all these like public deals and everyone's getting kickbacks. So
my understanding of the Chicago political system is that it is like politicians have a ton of power and also can just be super corrupt and make all their own rules. So you really want to win that election, I guess.
I'm going to be learning a lot more about aldermen soon, thanks to Wikipedia.
I thought you were like, I'm moving to Chicago.
Running for alderman. I'm announcing it here for the first time with a podcast, alderman of Southside. I'm the perfect candidate. There's just so many little moments. I mean, talking about what David just said, it's like you're excited to stumble into some of these. You know, seeing Elizabeth Debicki buy guns at a gun show. Everything about this movie is like, it's comedy, it's Ocean's 11 style operational mapping, but it's also commentary. It's you know, how many days after a shooting did I see this movie? Not many, because it's always happening. And then I'm watching her buy guns so easily at a gun show. It's like, this is an absurd thrill. It's such a strange experience. And then Michelle Rodriguez who I think is phenomenal. I think she's a great actress, and I got mad at the Fast movies in retrospect after seeing Widows for just wasting her time and time again. She's a very good actress.
But this is a recurring theme in the movies that have been adapted from Gillian Flynn stuff, and I guess in the television show as well, in that they take a lot of actors. I mean, there's people like Viola Davis and the GOAT, Elizabeth Debicki, who are great all the time. But there are people like Colin Farrell who have had some ups and downs, people like Ben Affleck in Gone Girl, people like Michelle Rodriguez who have been stifled in the shitty Fast and Furious movies, which are only getting worse. And there's something about the luridness of these stories that allows them to tap into either what we loved about them as actors in the first place or a new part of themselves that we haven't been able to fully appreciate before, but has always been there, sort of driving their talent in other areas. Just a second what Patches said. I mean, it's really thrilling to see Michelle Rodriguez come into her own in this performance. I mean, she's been great before, but here she is great in a way that, in a different way that she's been in a while. And there's like a softer side to her as a mother in this movie that I think she plays really, really well.
What do you think of the scene? It got a little chuckle in my theater, and I understand why, but I was pretty moved by it. So she's scouting to find the building. They've discovered blueprints to the target, and they don't actually know what the building is going to be. Yes, it's straight from The Aviator. But so she has discovered who drew them, so she kind of shows up this person's house pretending to be part of the architecture firm, and it turns out what she didn't realize is that the illustrator, or the architect I should call them, of the blueprints is dead, and her husband is there, and she's flustered, and they start kissing. It's crazy.
Yeah,
like they have
weird.
This emotional moment. But what did you make of that? I mean that's where this movie can play the full orchestra and just go to 11, and I'm still there. Like I, and maybe it's the actors, and maybe it's, I'm trying to figure out what McQueen does in this movie that makes all of this thunderous Baroque quality, you know, play, even though it's naturalistic.
Yeah. I don't know what to make of that scene. It's also been a while since I saw it. So I think it also got a chuckle in the background. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know how to fit that into the movie that I remember. David, you can solve
yeah,
the problem.
Yeah, no, what you said. I don't know. send us our screeners. Let us watch it again. We don't get paid money. We need our DVDs. We need our shitty watermarked DVDs.
You need to stage a heist.
Yeah.
All right, so David, your obvious MVP in this is Elizabeth Debicki.
Yeah, and also in everything. If you haven't, I mean, if you've been listening to the segment and hearing me just rave about Elizabeth Debicki, but don't have proper context for that. Not only can you go and rewatch The Great Gatsby, in which she is fucking amazing, and contrary to what you may remember, a lot of things in that movie are fucking amazing, but she in particular, but if you have the stomach for it, earlier this year, there was a movie that we talked about on this podcast, premiered at Sundance, it was on HBO, called The Tale, in which Elizabeth Debicki plays a decidedly less, sympathetic character. Then she does in Widows, and there were dim moments in that movie that definitely had my jaw on the floor, or at least punched me hard enough in the gut that everything else sort of went slack. So I think she's really, and she's Elizabeth even amazing. She's even amazing in Guardians of the Galaxy Part 2 as the giant like golden thing alien.
She's amazing in the Cloverfield Paradox, which sucks.
Oh, I did her the favor of forgetting that she's in that. And I'm going to keep it that way.
Elizabeth Debicki, more like Elizabeth Pick Me for a movie that people actually see.
Chicken, Elizabeth Debicki in a Cloverfield movie.
Bang it out. Get the clicks. Katie, what about you? Who's your MVP to wrap up?
I go back and forth all the time.
The dog.
Daniel Kaluuya.
The dog.
Listen, the dog is fine. I'm no fan of tiny dogs. Like, I would not pick a Westie. So I like, I'm not like Olivia.
But
the
she carries it the whole movie. Like, you can't overemphasize how much this dog is in this movie.
It's true. The dog is not in the heist, but it may as well have been.
The dog gets its own scene where it's dropped off at the kennel before the heist. The dog is important.
I mean, one of the best scenes in the movie is when Brian Tyree Henry comes to her apartment and is holding the dog the whole time, and you were just petrified of what he's going to do to this
Lord.
Dog. You've seen what Danny Kaluuya is capable of.
Do you think he grabbed that dog by the scruff like that? It has to be CG.
I mean, you can grab a dog by the scruff.
I know you can grab a dog by the scruff. I'm just saying, would you grab a dog by the scruff on a movie set like that? By the way, we haven't mentioned Brian Tyree Henry, but I thought he was great in this movie, too.
He's great.
That scene and the scene where he first talks with Colin Farrell, who's trying to intimidate him to kind of bow out of the political race. Yeah. I love that scene where he's like, I'm going to fuck you over, and I'm going to be top dog in the city, and I'm going to get my kickbacks and F off. Get out of here.
When intense. Beale Street comes out, we will revisit the subject of Brian
Great.
Tyree Henry.
I am very excited for that.
Brian Tyree Henry is having a hell of a year. But yeah, I think Daniel Kaluuya might be my favorite just because he's so effective. He is the primary villain of the movie. You kind of need him there as this threat to show how real everything is and believe that they're going to go through with it. And he does so much of it saying nothing. Like his face, we really got to kind of marvel at and Get Out. Like the whole power of the sunken place scenes is him being literally unable to speak and conveying so much on his face anyway. Yeah. And he's doing it in such a different way in this.
There's a scene where he enters the house of Garrett Dillahunt, who plays Viola Davis's driver, and he's going to beat the guy to a pulp to get some information out of him. And McQueen makes a really interesting decision. Instead of watching the goons beat the shit out of the guy, they stay on Kaluuya, who's just sitting in a chair, again, angel of death, like watching it happen. It's terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah, we ran along on Widows. Go see Widows.
John Bernthal's Widows.
Oh, fuck John Bernthal. He's the only person I don't like.
Oh, what about Matt Walsh? Matt Walsh's Widows. He's in the movie, too.
Matt Walsh is in it?
Yeah, he plays the CEO who has had sex with his niece and is being blackmailed.
Right. Matt Walsh's Widows.
And Lucas Haas.
Yeah, Lucas Haas. He's good. And that does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week. Once again, happy Thanksgiving. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm senior entertainment editor at Polygon.com. I really loved Widows, if you couldn't tell. And we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to episodes, you can share them with friends, or you can just talk to a chicken who will probably do a better job.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on the internet at Twitter. You can find me on IndieWire writing about wildlife. Shout out, call back to our reviews section at the top of the episode. You can also find me writing about Robin Hood, saying less flattering things. The embargo for that is Tuesday. I don't think this episode's coming up before then, so I'm safe to say that. Not good. You can find me watching the video of Gritty fighting a young boy fighting Gritty, I should say, on NHL.com. You can find all of us together on Facebook, where we don't just steal your data and play weird anti-Semitic mind game, whatever the fuck they're doing. I can't even remember so many mind news circles ago. Cycles. You can find us at Fighting in the War Room on Facebook. Gritty!
What are you talking about?
Talking about Gritty. I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can also find my other podcast, Storm Spoilers, where this week I'll be going even more in-depth into Fantastic Beasts and why I did not like it.
I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at VanityFair.com and eating turkey somewhere. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. And we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where I'd love to hear your favorite cast member of Widows, or you can answer this week's lightning round question, which was,
in honor of the favorite, what's your favorite cinematic pet?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week. I'm in it.